and severe wildfires. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 19th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at our new phone number, 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Lexis Ponce, Kenny B., Dejon, and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Zamone Perez, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and that's at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Sherry Meredith. Thank you for listening. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Kenny B. I'm joined by Tom Hilton, a Portland-based director who is showcasing four of his short films at the Clinton Street Theater on June 1st. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Kenny.
So you have an exciting showcase coming up of four of your short films. Let's talk through some of them real quick.
Let's talk through some of them real quick. Okay, you want just like a little gist of each of them?
Yes, I would. What is Synonymous With about?
Okay, Synonymous With is my first short film. It's from 2021, and it is a fictional documentary about a horror host in upstate New York who works on a public access TV channel that is abruptly shut down, and how he deals with losing this show that he self-produced for 10 years.
Ooh. And what is One Drift and We All Go Home about?
That's a really special one. One Drift is a real documentary. It is about a fish camp in Kenai, Alaska, where commercial salmon fishing was closed for a summer, and dozens of commercial fishermen lost their entire income in about 2 weeks. And this is a really special film in terms of construction because all of the primary source material was filmed by my father, also named Tom Hilton, who was a commercial fisherman who was working at the camp in 1998.
Oh, wow.
And I took that footage and reconstructed it into this film. And then it is titled after a poem that my father wrote about the experience. And so the finale of the piece is him present day reading that poem.
That sounds really special.
It's really lovely. That's a very personal one.
Aw. And what does You Look Pretty Up There about?
Yes, you look pretty up here.
Up here, I mean.
That is very tender little romantic drama, which is filmed up in Rhododendron, Oregon. That one is about a couple that has recently broken up, and the boyfriend of the couple goes to his dad's summer home to get some relaxation and rest and thinking time. And his ex-girlfriend had a plan to break into the cabin and do the same thing herself. So they are forced together for one day to kind of hash out their stuff and move on together.
Wow. Yeah. And what is Matinee Baby about?
Matinee Baby. That is a movie that I made with Pam Cutt, Portland Art Museum Center for an Untold Tomorrow. Ooh. And it is about two best friends, Robbie and Noah Lee, who are employees at Portland's historic 110-year-old Clinton Street Theater. And Robbie is being pursued by these very strange, kind of increasingly wacky, genre-tinged suitors. The customers go to see the movies at the Clinton, and they come out kind of affected.
Ooh.
So there's a cowboy, there is a kind of Hitchcock blonde, played by local multi-hyphenate clown drag performer Carla Rossi. It's a really fun, silly movie.
It sounds really fun.
Yeah.
And you have an upcoming film called Waking Up from a Nap on a Long Day of Doing Nothing. What is that about?
You got it. Yeah, the title is totally normal and concise in its length. That film is currently fundraising, and it is going to be about Portland's iconic First Thursday, the 40-year tradition of hosting new gallery shows in the Pearl District. And it's about a young artist who is making his public art debut at one of these shows. He's very nervous, so he spends the entire day with his best friend skateboarding around Portland, going to all these locations to try and relieve that anxiety. So there's going to be dozens of characters and locations all crammed into this really short time. I'm really excited to make that.
I bet. And I read in the description of that film that there's a mystical grandpa. What is the meaning of that?
Wow. Well,
or what makes him mystical?
This grandpa is based on my grandfather and the family's resident KBOO fan, Grandpa Jim.
Oh.
And Jim is a really special spiritual person who is in tune with the weird and the deep emotional colors within everybody. And so my grandfather is playing a version of himself who is the grandfather of the main character in the film. And we were very lucky to go to his retirement community in October and record a performance with him that will be incorporated into the film. He's kind of guiding our main character in a almost like a shaman kind of way throughout the piece.
All right. Now, I have a couple other questions for you. How long have you been writing and directing?
Well, I started writing when I was a sophomore in high school. I was part of the Promising Playwrights program, which was a really wonderful program from Portland Center Stage at the Armory, where they had outreach to a bunch of high schools. They would teach students playwriting, and then four of those short plays that we would write in class would be selected for a showcase and presented at JAW New Playwrights Festival at the Armory. So I got to do that. And then about 5 years ago in COVID times was when I started writing my first short film. It's when I started writing synonymous with. I met a wonderful stand-up comedian named Remy Germanario, who is the lead of that film. And I was looking at him one day and I said, you should be this young gay Vincent Price guy. And all of this stuff just started coming in. And after I finished making that, my dad sent me those tapes for One Drift and We All Go Home. And so that film kind of naturally rolled along. And then a friend of mine wrote the story that You Look Pretty Up Here is based on. He presented me with an early draft of that. We wrote it together. That kind of rolled along. And then Matinee Baby also grew out very naturally of some stand-up comedy kind of character work that I was doing in New York at the time. So they've all had this really natural, beautiful journey.
And are there any directors that you take inspiration from?
Yeah, my main guy, David Lynch, is my guy. A profound recent loss. And just his work speaks to the kind of deepest, lowest hum in my heart. And he always hits this note of, you know, mystical, spooky, funny, romantic. And it's always his idea at the forefront. Whatever is inspiring to him is worthy to be on screen. And we are along for the ride. And that is what I hope to do.
All right.
Yeah.
How long does it usually take for you to shoot your films?
I think Synonymous shot for 6 days. One Drift, you know, when you really break it down, that took about 25 years to make.
Fair.
Which is cool. And then You Look Pretty Up Here and Matinee Baby, about 4 or 5 days. It's really not, because the run times of these are so short, between 15 and 20 minutes, it's not a lot of really intensive shooting time. What takes the most time for a project like this is planning everything to make that short shoot as effective as possible, as efficient as possible. And the process that we're in now with the Waking Up From a Nap movie, which is getting the resources to make it possible.
All right. And how do you approach crowdfunding for your films and projects?
You know, it is this really beautiful challenge where you have to put yourself out there and ask for help, which is the most challenging step.
Yes.
Saying, I need something. I really want to do something. I feel worthy of your time and your hard-earned money to make something that you will enjoy being a part of. And it's this consistent reminding of friends, family, the community, which I guess is why I'm here and why I'm doing this event, that that I'm inviting you to come be a part of something with me, and that we just need, really in the grand scheme of things, a little bit of money, which is incredibly significant for me. And part of the justification for this is that I, you know, submit to screenwriting competitions and really hone the script and dial it in to make sure that it is worthy of being shot now. So, for example, this Waking Up script had a juried stage reading at the Coeur d'Alene International Film Festival in Reno. It won Best Screenplay at the Bridgeport Film Festival in Connecticut. So I'm really, you know, putting in the time to show we're ready to do it.
All right. And how do you find venues to show your films?
Ask.
Fair ask. Enough.
Yeah. The Clinton Street Theater and I have a really wonderful relationship because I co-host the Rocky Horror Picture Show there. I do a wonderful show called Rocky Horror for Virgins. I guess it's now called the Rocky Horror Picture Show with Tom Hilton. And so they're this wonderful home base for me. And like I said, Matinee Baby is filmed there. It's really a film about that theater. You know, the Tomorrow Theater is where we premiered Matinee Baby because Pam Cutt sponsored it. And then last summer with Matinee Baby, I had this wonderful opportunity to do what was called the Portland Pride Tour, where at the Laurelhurst Theater and at the Hollywood Theater and the Clinton, we showed Matinee Baby paired with queer films, Cinema 21 as well. And you just get there from asking and saying, like, hey, you want to check this out and think it's a good fit?
Alrighty. And what do you hope people take away from your films? I know it's a little bit of a loaded question.
Yeah, it's kind of a broad question, right? Because for me, the film is it. That's the whole thing. All of my idea and all of myself goes into making that. And whatever you see and take away from it is your job and your joy, or maybe, you know, your distaste if you don't like it. How does it move you? How does it make you laugh? It's like having a conversation with me, right?
All right.
And my intent is always going to be different than my impact in a conversation or in something I write or something I direct. So it's not really up to me.
All right. And do you have any movie recommendations for your audience?
Oh, well, yeah, I really do. So in June, you know, the Clinton Street Theater is kicking off its Pride Month screenings with this on June 1st. But there's a bunch of other really wonderful movies that I'm so excited to see in June. Ooh. At the Clinton. June 3rd on the big screen is My Own Private Idaho, which is the quintessential Portland queer film made by Gus Van Sant, starring the late River Phoenix, also co-starring Udo Kier, who is an incredible German actor who I was really lucky to work with in a film called Swan Song. It's just beautiful, and everyone should go see it. And my colleague at the Clinton, Violet Hex, is showing three showings of But I'm a Cheerleader with Natasha Lyonne and Mink Stole and RuPaul. It's just so fun. These screenings sell out. They get totally crazy. And that's two shows on June 20th and one show on June 27th. And then on June 28th, I think it's just about like my dream day, which is that the Clinton is showing Mamma Mia 2, Here We Go Again, twice at 3 p.m. and at 7 p.m. And then I'm hosting Rocky Horror. So you could go to Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Then you could go, you could say, Here We Go Again to Here We Go Again, twice. And then you could come to Rocky, just make it an all day thing. And that's a whole—
And a change of clothes.
Yeah. I mean, you could come as Christine Baranski to the first screening. You could come as Meryl Streep's ghost to the second screening. And then you could come as Meryl Streep's ghost dressed as Dr. Frankenfurt. Mash it up.
Yeah.
You know?
And where can listeners find out more information if they're interested?
More information about me. You can look up my Instagram is THOMJH. I'm posting about the fundraiser. I'm posting about the event. You can buy tickets for this event, Shorts by Tom Hilton, on June 1st at 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater's website. That is cstpdx.com. And there are links both through my social media and the Clinton's website as well to the fundraiser for Waking Up from a Nap and a Long Day of Doing Nothing. We're crowdfunding through June 2nd on Indiegogo. So this is like the big finale of our crowdfunder. We're about a third of the way to our budget goal right now.
That's amazing. And do you have any final thoughts for this interview?
Go see these wonderful queer movies, not even the ones that I made, but the ones that I talked about. Please support the Clinton. And I guess a final thought that I mentioned Portland Center Stage was the place where I started writing originally. They are currently hosting a big fundraiser as well. If you're in the mood for giving after you give to my movie, go check out the Save Portland Center Stage campaign. These are the vital cultural institutions of our community, and we want to keep them going strong forever.
All right. Thank you so much for sitting in on this interview with me.
Thanks, Kenny.
That was Tom Hilton, a Portland-based director who is showcasing four of his short films at the Clinton Street Theater on June 1st. For KBOO News and Def, I'm Kenny B.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Lexis Ponce. The Trump administration and its Department of Government Efficiency are making so many changes so quickly that it's often difficult to follow everything that's going on. The Revolving Door Project is trying to remedy that situation by providing a range of resources for the media and the public. The project is regularly updating resources that track public health crises and the Trump's administration defiance of court orders, as well as profiles of DOGE personnel. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Jeff Hosser, the executive director of the Revolving Door Project.
I'm thinking that your organization is used to keeping pretty close track of things, but when the second Trump administration came in, were even you kind of surprised at how fast things were moving?
Absolutely. We were worried about the level of corruption. We felt that the second Trump administration was going to be even more corrupt than the first, and we felt that the first Trump administration would have made Richard Nixon a little bit feel a little awkward had he been president. So we had very low expectations, but Trump has managed to go way lower than we ever imagined possible.
So when did you start your tracking system? Was it pretty much within a month?
We identified DOGE and Elon Musk as big reasons why this administration is different. I mean, that I don't think we should make it only about Elon Musk. Russell Vogt, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, was a key figure in the Trump first administration, and he is the key architect of Project 2025. And we knew he'd been thinking about things, and we'd done research on Russell Vogt, but we did not fully understand how much Trump felt like he'd been a victim, and that that authorized him to go and use the government not only to enrich himself, but to unleash havoc on all forces that tended to look down upon him. And having Elon Musk to backstop some of the least qualified people that have ever stepped foot into a government office meant that the Doge figures break laws with impunity. They know that Elon Musk tends to never be held accountable for what laws he breaks, and that with Elon Musk behind them, they really could fear no repercussions from law. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing what happens when people run the government without any feeling that they need to follow the law.
When you're tracking what's going on with Doge, does it make it even more difficult when they do something and then they roll it back and then they do it again?
So Doge does make tracking itself very difficult for many reasons. One is that it tries to act in the dark. It doesn't announce itself. It is pro-opacity, anti-transparency. Secondly, they only sort of maybe a little bit comply with judicial orders. They will reverse course to some extent when a judge rules against them, which is, you know, pretty frequent, but we don't know how much they will comply, and that it's always a moving target. They will also sometimes move back when somebody in the government, the Trump administration, disagrees and they get word to Trump or Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, and there's a slight retrenchment of the extremist actions that Musk and his teenagers are undertaking. So it is very difficult to keep tabs on, but that's part of why we're trying to track it. We think that people hear little bits and pieces of different stories about Doge, but it's very hard to keep track of the breadth of the repercussions. And that's what we are doing now and what we hope to expand upon in the future.
Do you see what they're doing as very incompetent and even inefficient, even though they're supposed to be creating more efficiency?
I don't think they take efficiency seriously in any sense. I think that the name Doge is not only a joking reference to a particularly stupid type of cryptocurrency, but I think that Department of Government Efficiency was good marketing that has absolutely nothing to do with the mission of Doge. The mission of Doge is to attack the type of people that Elon Musk and Donald Trump think look down upon them or get in their way or hindrances to them. Elon Musk, across all of his businesses, runs into problems with the law. That can be the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, because there's a lot of employment discrimination that occurs at Musk companies. It can be NHTSA, the Highway Transportation Agency, because Teslas tend to crash needlessly. It can be the FAA because of the bad actions of SpaceX. You name one of his companies, it is often getting in the way of multiple government regulators. So Elon Musk hates government because Elon Musk does not like being told what to do. He is essentially a petulant preteen who's just like rather large and rich, but he is a rich, large preteen, and that he is taking a wrecking ball against the things that he dislikes. Efficiency has absolutely nothing to do with it. And obviously Donald Trump is pretty similar in terms of his mentality. So I think we should ignore the name and not believe it has anything to do with the actual mission of the actual Doge that exists in reality.
Has your organization ever had to do anything like this before? This kind of
no,
tracking?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we were definitely at times critics of the Biden administration. We are nonpartisan. We are against corporate influence in politics. And obviously, corporate influence exists when Democrats are in charge, when Republicans are in charge. You know, we did not like Jeffrey Zients being Biden's chief of staff for the final 2 years. He's essentially a private equity vulture capitalist. We think that had a lot of impact on how he managed the administration, and we criticized him in real time. So we've had to be critical of every past president, and we imagine we'll be critical of all presidents in the future, assuming, you know, civil society continues to exist in the future. But nothing of this scale. I mean, I think even Nixon had some patriotism, and I really don't see any patriotism in how this government is being run. There's no point other than to make progressives and liberals and the well-educated people who follow these things closely, the goal is to make them angry. There is no alternative vision on order. This is not an issue of ideology. This is people having a temper tantrum and the consequence is a broken government.
Do you know if other authoritarian type governments around the world operate this way, or do they not bother with the kind of thing Trump and Musk are doing in terms of these agencies?
I mean, I think there are aspects of the Doge and Trump approach of smashing things and leaving everyone on edge that are common to authoritarian countries when leaders are accumulating power and destroying their enemies and destroying the types of institutions which are semi-permanent and therefore can stand in the way of new leaders consolidating power. So I think there are elements of it in that regard. I think this is kind of unusually just broadly destructive and quickly of the operations of government in the sense that a lot of what they're doing is really just destroying agencies to be destroying agencies. Like they're going after aspects of the State Department that are useful to making America more powerful around the world. And you would think they would want that capacity. You would think they would take over things like Voice of America and use it to spout MAGA propaganda, you know, maybe support Orban, support Putin and other international allies. I think they are breaking things in a really irrational manner. I mean, there definitely are huge components of corruption here. Don't get me wrong. It's not all irrational. People, rich people know that they're getting some favors done for them. But also there are rich people who sometimes rely on things like having the NOAA, the part of the Commerce Department that looks into whether, like, get correct information so that American agriculture can benefit, American transportation. Tornado warnings are a good thing for people across ideology, and whether or not you remember the 1% or the 99%. So some of this is really ad hoc, but I think it also means that everyone feels threatened, and threatened people might be more willing to kick bribes to the administration than unthreatened people. So at some level, he's just sending a message, there are no sacred cows. I or we, depending on Trump or Musk or how you want to think about it, they are sending a message that we can bust anything that we want.
Yeah, and I would think that some corporate leaders would be a little upset because they kind of like regulation in the sense that it kind of organizes their industries, not the kind that limits them too much, but there is a kind of regulation that just makes it easier for them to operate. Do you get that sense?
I mean, there are obviously many different types of corporations. I think many traditional corporate leaders are probably appalled and were actually probably upset even before the Trump tariff was put in place in such a wildly ad hoc and, you know, apparently generated by artificial intelligence, or at least plausibly may have been so generated. I think that they have been upset. It is not for the in the interest of their business. But I also think that there's a little bit of a backlash against civil society that's been occurring among elites. I think there were a series of interviews that Marc Andreessen, the Silicon Valley titan, gave between the run-up, between the election and inauguration. And I don't think he was just speaking for himself or even necessarily Silicon Valley in complaining that rich people are being vilified on academic universities and people who build things should be accorded great power and great respect, and that that wasn't adequate, that young people were coming out of university too woke in their terms. I think there's a lot of deep-seated anger by a lot of rich people that they are not getting the respect that they feel like they deserve. And I think that, you know, to many of us, the incredible growing economic inequality in this country suggests that rich people being concerned about level of respect is insane. But just because it's insane doesn't mean it isn't happening. So while I think a lot of rich people have, and corporate executives wish it were being done somewhat differently and somewhat in some regards, I think they are enjoying some of the disquietude that they are inflicting upon people that have bothered them in the past. I think that there's some schadenfreude happening in corporate C-suites that is really speaks very badly about them, but I think it's no less real for that fact.
And you mentioned the tariffs. I take it that is something you're following pretty closely, the back and forth on that?
I mean, we're following it closely. I mean, we're not trade experts, but you don't need to be a trade expert to think that these trade policies are incredibly poorly designed. You also don't even have to be a zealot that says that tariffs are never imaginably decent to say that these tariff policies, where we're tariffing islands full of penguins and without people, that you're generating fake formulas that are, bear no relation to any economic theory, like that's just not how you run a country, that's not how you're going to reindustrialize the United States, that this is all ridiculous, that it opens up the avenue for corporations to make special pleadings with Trump for exceptions. And I'm sure that pleading for exceptions, they'll be willing to do things in return for said exceptions. So there's a certain type of logic for Trump. But outside of that, there's no logic for the national interest. And that's why we fear corporate influence in politics, is that, you know, if corporations think that they can get exceptions, they're not going to fight back against this sort of thing. But I mean, to some extent, corporations brought about this administration, they brought about this government, they brought about a Congress that is compliant with this administration, and they are going to have to deal with it. And some of them are going to place the right bribes at the right moment, and they're going to stay on the right side of the administration, and others will not. And hopefully there'll be a lesson learned and we can change this type of politics. But the politics of the moment are distressing.
And if people want to find what you're tracking, would they just go to your website? Would that be the best thing?
So if you go to therevolvingdoorproject.org, it's just /Dogewatch is where we have a link to all the various trackers that we've already created, and we're going to be creating more in the future. Or you can just Google Revolving Door Project. We also have a free Substack at least twice a week, where we are focusing on both broad themes about corporate influence in our politics, as well as a weekly corruption calendar, where we try to give you a sense of the breadth of corruption that's occurring in Trump's America. And we always take ideas from people. But yeah, all the information is free and it's a public service.
That's Jeff Hauser of the Revolving Door Project speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Lexis Ponce.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Michael Van Cleek, Vice President of KBOO's Board of Directors. The KBOO Board is recruiting new directors. KBOO's nominee.